Welcome world, this is DJ Synergy, your host for Culture Crossover. Today we resume classes after a much deserved spring break, which was so totally awesome. For my break, I went with a small group of people from Dominican to be a cabin leader at a camp called Caritas, and all week I was immersed in nature and only had my phone on me at most like an hour each day. This experience was so inspiring, and it really just showed me how a social media break can really do wonders. And I was also surrounded by about 100 sixth graders all day, every day, which was pretty interesting to see what they're following in the world of social media, which seemed to me that they're most enthused about what everyone was doing on Vine and all the viral happenings on Vine. And Vine has just been such a viral tool for the rest of the rest of the world, and so I thought that the broadcasts, the remaining ones that I will attribute my last segment to, be about what went viral within the last weeks. And first, let's get into my first segment, which is called It's All in the Gray. So for those that are just tuning in, you're listening to Culture Crossover, which is hosted by me, DJ Synergy. It's All in the Gray is a segment where I discuss current entertainment news that is controversial, and I just kind of deliberate on these subjects. Our first story today discusses the objectification of women in televised commercials. What inspired this was I was browsing through BuzzFeed just the other day, and I came across their new video, which was a reenactment of commercials that showed women in provocative poses to advertise the products that were being sold, like fast food and body wash, stuff like that. Just general everyday use products and the over-sexualization of women. This tactic of selling products isn't new, and it's essentially existed since the very beginning of the advertisement industry, probably half a century ago. And seeing men like this is ridiculous. When you watch the video, it's so odd to see men trying to portray a sexy image in order to sell a hamburger. But it isn't for women. And I think this is because women attract more attention and society's like made them think that it's normal to be doing this when really it's not normal at all. Women talk about equal rights and treatment, yet they don't really mind it when they're being used for their sex appeal. Women who are portrayed like this, I just think it's a shame because women should be advocating for the discontinuation of over-sexualized advertisements, because it really does affect the whole population of women when you're seeing them being portrayed in certain ways. And our culture today just accepts women as objects, which advertisers can teach women by a very early age to invest in products to be beautiful and flawless. And that's really what every magazine article and every commercial on TV is trying to sell to women, to convince them that they need this certain product in order to obtain beautiful, which is really, it just is actually, I think, damaging our whole culture makeup. And I watched a video in my ethics class, which is entitled Killing Us Softly. It recounts how unrealistic the ideals of the perfect woman are and how it triggers our culture to accept women as objects. And in it, the woman who's talking, she is trying to convince us and trying to show us that it leads to violence. And the ways in which women are portrayed in ads sends a message that violence and abuse is logical, which is the result of the objectification. And when our bodies are objectified, it eroticizes the violence against women. At first, I was sort of thrown off by this because I wasn't totally convinced that product advertisements showcasing women in a sexual way was truly leading to violence and desensitization in rape culture. Like, when you're watching TV and commercials come on, you're not really provoked and thinking, oh, this is totally an example of why women and rape culture exists. And the news came out this week about Lady Gaga's performance, the stunt that she pulled at her SXSW performance, which it totally, like, it clicked for me when I was watching or I was reading about the whole incident where her name is Millie Brown, and she is a performance artist who actually uses paint and vomits it up to create her masterpieces. And this violence in our culture is seldom discussed, which is to be expected because society fights hard to conceal its flaws, but Lady Gaga is an ambassador for equal rights and social justice. And the singer, when she was vomited on by Millie Brown at the SXSW Festival in Austin, it sent a total negative reaction out of everyone, which I think is really important, which because it's a way in which she is making people talk about rape culture and the like. When I heard of this news, I was totally shocked myself, and it was baffling to me why Lady Gaga would even be concerned or not concerned, but coerced into doing this. And after reading more into it, the song she was performing at the time, which is when Millie Brown does this, it's a song, it's called Swine, and it's about rape and rage, as Lady Gaga has explained. And it's about the awful things that have happened during her pursuit of the fame, which her whole target for the performance was to be shocking. And it wasn't meant to be pretty because, yes, it was probably meant to grab headlines, but there's a deeper meaning behind all of this. The song is called Swine for a reason. The song tells a story of women that was of a woman that was physically abused and raped, and the pig is used to describe how the woman feels and how she is treated. She feels dirty, abused, and used. The woman equates her worth to a pig because of how she was abused and how she doesn't know anything else besides the pain and treatment she has been subjected to by her man. The song may or may not be about Gaga's personal experiences, but the woman puking on Gaga is an artist that is famous for spitting paint on canvases and create her art pieces. The vomiting in the performance represents the woman purging her prior experiences and going on with life. So when you really look into the story behind everything, it's pretty beautiful, and I think that this artistic approach really is not something that most common artists really think about, or they would probably say, oh, that's a little bit too edgy and could be a little bit risky for my whole crowd following. Like, I don't want to be so out there and everything. But Lady Gaga does it, and I think she did it perfectly. Because after Gaga's puked on, she goes on performing. And because of the meaning of this song, the performance wasn't pretty, and I'm really glad that it wasn't. At the end of the day, she's an artist, and she was trying to create a public conversation about physical abuse and rape culture. While she hasn't come right out and said it or accused anyone in particular, those who paid attention for the last few years may have picked up on the trauma, whether self-inflicted or otherwise, of Lady Gaga. For instance, in 2011, the video for Marry the Night finally addressed the drug-fueled breakdown that she had after being dropped from her first label, even suggesting that she may have miscarried as a consequence. Since Art Pop was released, Gaga has been vocally critical of the recording industry that finds talents and squeezes as much money from it without regards to artistic integrity or human fragility. Then again, I figured they would start yanking on the leash once she wasn't able to sell as much, because when Gaga first started, she was she wasn't as risky, and she was pretty much just a pop star, and she did have her whole edge to her that she was an advocate for equal rights. And then you go in a little bit further, and she really, really just, she has no guard, she has no boundaries, and that turned a lot of people off. And the industry only allows artists to be as creative as she is, as long as they want, in order, as long as they're doing what they want, but also bringing in the money that the industry is needing and her producers are needing. And it was her remarks about what it's like for women in the music industry that was an unsettling reminder. The misogyny, the hands on thighs, sitting on laps, things most male artists probably will never have to deal with. And she admitted she did things she's not proud of to do whatever it took to advance her career. Yes, she's made her own decisions and must deal with the consequences of her actions, but I think it further proves that the systematic problems that all women deal with. It doesn't matter how talented or smart a woman is, there's always someone reminding her to get back to what the whole gender role is telling her to do, and she should be living by the norm that our culture has set. And she is essentially trying to de-objectify herself, like I was saying earlier in the other commercial that swapped roles and showed men being or portraying the way that women are portrayed in television commercials. And yet, it's really ironic that we're subjected to a near constant depictions of violence on radio and the movies and video games. But the moment a woman throws up in a performance, it shakes the very foundations of the internet. Blood and gore, violence against women and children, even rape jokes are fine. But a woman expressing a painful issue that many can really relate to is deemed inappropriate and offensive. Swine is about rape, and it's not about bulimia, as other stories are saying. It's about the trauma that a person lives with. The deceptively unbeat track is like the facade a victim puts up. Perhaps they can deny the experience if they were to put on a mask or make it seem like things are okay when they're really in turmoil. Rape is a subject that isn't taken seriously enough, and it never ceases to amaze me how people don't know when the line is crossed, what actually constitutes rape, or that it isn't really about sex but power over another. Rape is an assault against another's mind, body, and soul, and it happens to the rich, the poor, every race, religion, and gender. And we really need to start taking it more seriously. I'm not telling people they're wrong for being disgusted or disturbed by the performance, but it's just that there are so many people jumping on Gaga glamorizes eating disorders bandwagon that the point is missed entirely. And could she have not used Millie Brown? I mean, sure, but could she have just poured paint on herself? That's could have been it too, but I don't think it would have had the same visceral impact. For those who have seen it, it makes one like feel something. It makes you really think about, you look at the whole, I guess, traumatizing event of when Millie vomits on Gaga, but then you get to thinking and it provokes a reaction. And not enough artists are really doing this these days, so I commend Gaga for this. And there needs to be more artists like this. While some online sources discuss rape and the core inspiration of the song and performance, other places are saying it's a glorification of bulimia. E! Online is one place where I found the story to never mention anything about rape, but discusses Gaga's performance as an ode to eating disorders. The article reads, "After all, the 27-year-old songstress has spoken publicly about her struggles while eating disorders with eating disorders in the past, including suffering from bulimia and anorexia since she was a teenager." And in 2012, she posted a revealing photo of herself wearing only a bra and underwear on littlemonsters.com, as well as tweeted to her fans to join a body revolution and captioned the pic, "Bulimia and anorexia since I was 15. And just last month, she opened up in Harper's Bazaar about how she's since overcome her body issues. When Gaga was asked about her performance, she explained that she's known Millie for about 5 years now and that they've collaborated before. and she had just been in town, so they thought that they could collaborate again. It was just really exciting to see people talk about performance art on the internet, says Gaga. We really just did it because we believe in the performance and we believe in what it meant to the song. And amid all the puking panic, it seems as though Gaga is moving forward and focusing on her next big career move, which is her forthcoming music video. She posted a revealing and yet totally confusing picture from the video on her website and wrote, "New Lady Gaga video next Saturday, hashtag I am art pop." Well, that will definitely be an interesting video, and I'm excited to see it and maybe even talk about it on my show next week. But their next story is all about Jennifer Lee, who is the first woman director to have earned $1 billion worldwide in ticket sales for her movie Frozen. The Oscars was about 2 Sundays ago, but it was so monumental that there's still plenty of news stories rushing in to the headlines. And what I noticed was the one with Jennifer Lee and what she's been asked most since her fame. The one question that she's been asked most is, what is the hardest part about being a female director? Which Jennifer Lee, she posted on LA Times with her whole entire explanation, and it's really eloquent. It reads, "I confess that I'm ready, so very ready, to get back to the freedom of the story room. Tough notes and all. It's not about me being a female director. It's not about me being 5'3". In the story room, my boobs fit just fine, because in the story room, it's the only size of my imagination that matters." Jennifer Lee's words are inspiring because too often we are judging the career choices of people by their gender. People think somehow your gender binds you to what you can achieve. However, Lee and other successful women like Gaga are defying gender roles and are increasingly proving that whatever you dream you may have, whatever dream you may have, or however many times you're confined by your gender, none of it matters so long as you have the passion and drive for it. And so this whole little segment today was just to sort of empower the women and how we're always brought down and everything. But over time, there are people who are going to act out in accordance with women to really just tell everyone, no, we're not going to be confined by what our gender is, and we're not going to stand up for this mistreatment. So thank you for listening. We're going to take a quick short break while I play you Lady Gaga's song Swine. I thought that would fit appropriately today. So we'll be right back. This is DJ Synergy. You're listening to my show Culture Crossover on radio.dominican.edu. Thank you all for listening. This is DJ Synergy. You are just listening to Swine by Lady Gaga, which she performed last week at the SXSW Music Festival in Texas. And it was just a performance where one artist ended up, her name's Millie Brown, she ended up vomiting on Lady Gaga to sort of represent the whole rape culture in our society. And so it was pretty headline breaker. The internet went to it and they're pretty upset about it, you know, shocked, which is to be expected, but it really got a conversation started. So for my next segment, I wanted to bring you into the whole indie era spectrum of the show. So today I was going to talk a little bit about Barack Obama and how in 2008 there was a huge following by young people who supported and helped Obama win the election. And nowadays we don't really ever see youth advocating for Barack Obama. You know, his term's almost over and no one of the younger generations really absolutely in support of him anymore. And the conversation kind of just quit a couple years ago. And that's just a sort of a flashing red light for Obama because he has this whole Affordable Care Act that he's trying to advocate for and no one's really listening to him. But now his whole strategy is to go out to, ambassadors of the younger generations who are symbols for how they can run the internet and how they can have huge followings and consistent viewership and everything. And so this past month, he had a gathering of a couple really, really popular YouTubers. Actually, they were invited to the White House. It was Thursday, February 27th, and he invited Hannah Hart of My Drunk Kitchen in Camp Dakota, Tyler Oakley of Being Awesome on the Internet, Iman Crosson, who the online video and Vine World knows as Alpha Cat, Michael Stevens of Vsauce, Benny and Rafi Fine of the Fine Bros, Mark Douglas, Todd Womack, and Ben Riles of YouTube's very own Barely Political, Peter Shuckoff and Lloyd Alquist of Epic Rap Battles of History, and Mickey Meyer and Daniel Kellison of burgeoning online comedy network Jash all sat around at a large conference table with the 44th president of the United States for the better part of an hour, and they discussed ways in which the White House could do a better job of reaching the YouTube generation. The meeting wasn't about any single topic, but it did sort of gravitate towards the Affordable Care Act with its impending March 31st deadline for open enrollment, and a quick brainstorm on how to disseminate unbiased information about the initiative was on the agenda. But it focused more on establishing an open dialogue between the Oval Office and outstanding members of the YouTube community. The hope among the attendees was the gathering will be the first of many, and that this recently established YouTube brain trust of sorts can help the White House, President Obama, and all future presidents of the United States more easily navigate the quickly evolving new media landscape. And it's not that the president doesn't want to know the importance of, or doesn't know the importance of online video, since way back in 2008 in November, he was still president-elect and he filmed weekly online video fireside chats where he addresses the camera and informs the online video masses on the current state of the union. But his whole mindset behind this is that he realizes that online video potential is a real thing, and he knows that he and his office could bring the medium more effectively, because never before in the history of the world has there been a more direct way for the President of the United States to inform and speak to his fellow Americans. But never before have his fellow Americans been so distracted from hearing his message. It was one thing for when Franklin Roosevelt addressed radio audiences in an era before the mass adoption of television. It's really another for Obama to fight for viewership from an audience on a platform that sees over 100 hours of videos uploaded every minute. And that's where the prominent YouTubers come into play, because they know how to be heard by the next generation of Americans on the medium with which they feel most comfortable. The meeting was orchestrated by the aforementioned Meyer, who reached out to his Jash coworker Kellison about organizing an in-person conversation between exceptional YouTubers and the president. Kellison, who is the White House's entertainment advisory council, helped put the wheels in motion, while Meyer reached out to establish members of the online video community. The get-together ended with a trip to the Oval Office, where Obama gave all the attendees a brief history of the room and pointed to everyone's attention towards the 1849 model of Samuel Morse's telegraph. He noted how the piece of machinery was the start of the internet before snapping a photo with some online video's most recognizable and influential personalities. And so Obama's really trying to reestablish his audience, and he's doing really everything in his power that he can to make it seem like they can have a bridge between online video and a good audience for Obama. This week saw the release of Obama's sit-down with comedian Zach Galifianakis of The Hangover fame to encourage the young to join the Obamacare exchanges. It was good comedy, and according to the White House, it had the desired result, which was a boost in traffic to healthcare.gov. Yet the fact that Obama sought Galifianakis' help was an indication of how much the president's standing has slipped among young Americans. Because 6 years earlier, he had been a demigod to most people among this demographic. So what really went wrong? The president and his aides failed to keep his youth movement engaged, But part of the problem was also the inability of the millennial generation to remain attached to a cause. As part of this millennial generation, I've observed instances where a huge following joins causes and in no time has abandoned its goals and missions. I've seen this in the CONY 2012 movement, where the Invisible Children organization gained a massive following on the internet essentially overnight, and then by the end of, let's say, 2 weeks, the cause had already been diminished due to bad publicity of the founder of the organization. And now I think this is exactly what's happening in the youth support of the Obama administration. Because the generation that brought Obama to power is connected online, but really has no loyalty to institutions, including, it turns out, to the Obama White House. In 2008, the level of innovation and engagement in the election, especially the primaries, were amazing, but then the levels of engaging them during the administration was really disappointing. And this was told by Peter Levine, a Tufts University professor who specializes in youth civic involvement. He had a potential for army. He had a potential army for legislative success and implementation, but the Obama administration did not do that. At a critical moment in the first term, they did not turn to them. They got rapid youth demobilization, he says. Young voters, I think, after playing a big role in the campaign, became really little more than an email list for the White House and Obama's organizing for action group. Then came the healthcare reform, and the polling by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center found that while the generation looks more favorably on big government solutions than do older generations, the millennials disapprove of Obamacare in the same proportion as the rest of the population. And even if Obama had worked harder to keep his youth army engaged, it's not entirely clear that the effort would have succeeded. As a group, the generation, its attachment is really fickle, and a Pew survey of the generation released earlier this month found that 18 to 33 crowd less attached to the older generations to organized politics and religion are less patriotic, less eager to marry, and less trusting of people. Only 49% say the phrase "a patriotic person" describes them very well, compared to the percentages ranging from 64% to 81% for older generations. The millennials are at least as passionate and as the older generations, but the millennials are really lacking just ties to institutions. That's really the ground bottom of it, because of their online existence, I think that they're just not attached to unions, political parties, or even churches. The organizational structure they're growing up in is just so weak, Tufts Levine tells me. As a result, aren't very many durable institutions that can capitalize on their enthusiasm. They're being asked to do it themselves online, and it's really a tall order. Asking them to pay money to join a healthcare exchange, it seems, is too much of a task, and even though the presidency they created, it really depends on it, it's just not anything that any millennial wants to really bind themselves by. So what I'm really trying to say here is that the Obama administration is trying to be that friendly go-to person, like, hey, you know, we can talk and we can expose our feelings and, you know, just have a chat and everything. But when it comes down to it, there's just not really much that the administration can do in order to convince a huge following. The millennials, they're, you know, we're young and we're crazy and free, and we're not really too concerned at this age for healthcare, which is, you know, like, for me, for example, I'm claimed by my parents, so why should I have to worry about that? And of course, it'll matter down the road, but for the time being, to depend on the millennials for their support isn't really anything that they can count on. And so it's kind of sad to say that Obama's been failing in this whole orchestration of the Health Care Act and everything. But, you know, that's just kind of how it is. Moving on, I found a little article that was discussing Bill Gates and his whole scene on his, or his whole take on the scene of online orchestration. So the Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates hasn't spoken much about technology since stepping away from daily duties at the company in 2006, but he's now had a bigger role at the firm, and Gates is talking a little more about the industry. In a wide-ranging discussion with Rolling Stone, Gates opened on everything from Edward Snowden, you won't find much admiration from me, to the laughable idea that America's best days are behind it. The full interview is well worth a read, but he also made an astute comment on the culture differences between Microsoft, Facebook, and Apple. These are probably the three biggest companies, or not probably, but they're definitely the big three companies that the young generation are following, and they're always looking for their new innovations and everything, and always on Facebook for social media needs. And the founders that shaped them, Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, and Bill Gates, all have a different take on how to succeed in the industry. So Bill Gates says, I start with architecture, and Mark Zuckerberg starts with products, and Steve Jobs started with aesthetics. It's a succinct explanation of how each company tends to approach its problems, and a good demonstration of just how much clout a founder's personality can have on a company. Facebook, with Zuckerberg at the helm, is focused on what products do, explaining the company's penchant for snapping up wholly formed companies such as WhatsApp or Instagram. For me personally, I would always hate it when I learned that Facebook bought out Instagram or Snapchat or something like that. But it's really, for a business decision, it's really smart, and it has such a good approach to it. So, I mean, that's why Zuckerberg is so successful at what he does. Apple was founded and tightly controlled by the artistic Jobs, who cares most about how the products look, feel, and fit into everyday life. Apparent from the obsessive detail it pays to polish and user experience, Microsoft and Gates, the self-proclaimed coder who tells Rolling Stones that he likes to be down in the bowels of things, puts the most effort into process and infrastructure. For better or for worse, that approach is likely to get even stronger as Gates heads back into the daily mix at Microsoft as technology advisor to Microsoft chief executive Satya Nadella. Gates has always been someone who has been a role model to the younger generation and just everyone in general. I think that everyone follows him and is just fascinated with his crazy amount of success in his life. And so to hear that, it was kind of cool to see what he really thinks the whole reasons are behind why each company is successful. I thought that was really cool. To bring us to another story of indie news, I found out that there is a new hair transplant approach, and that is for hipsters to get hair restoration surgeries in order to obtain the perfect hipster beard. In recent years, there's been quite a few advances in hair transplant, and the latest trend to come out of New York is the hipster beard. Stubble Challenge guys can now improve their appearance by transplanting hair from their back of their heads onto their cheeks, chins, and upper lips to create a full and natural beard. The Brethren of Brooklyn are getting facial hair transplants to fill the bald spots on their trendy beards, and New York media report that men are paying as much as $8,500 to have plastic surgeons add hair to their faces. Apparently, patchy whiskers just won't do in the hipster world. The tint is also popular with the female-to-male gender population, Hasidic Jews, and baby-faced dudes. The procedure is straightforward. A plastic surgeon will remove hair from another part of the body, the head, chest, wherever, and implants it in the face. A website that follows neighborhood news in New York appears to have spotted the trend. The procedures range from filling in bare patches to whole beard construction. Brooklyn's probably the nucleus of the trend. It's the hipster look guys want. If you have a spotty beard and you let it grow out, it looks sloppy. Jeffrey Epstein, a Midtown-based plastic surgeon, told the New York Post. He's performing 2 or 3 beard transplants a week, he said. A couple of years ago, he did maybe a handful. Sometimes patients bring in pictures of celebrities and male models they want to look like, including George Clooney, Ryan Gosling, and Brad Pitt. Some guys want the Tom Selleck mustache, too. One transplant patient told the Post that he was happy that he didn't have to fill in his scrawny beard with an eyebrow pencil anymore. Bless his happy little hipster heart. I thought that was just such a funny story because you always hear about the whole hipster beard scrutiny in the indie world and everything, but to actually think that there is a procedure that they can get done in order to really have the full effect. We're going to take another station break for a couple minutes. This is DJ Synergy. You're listening to my show Culture Crossover on radio.dominican.edu. Don't go away. We'll be right back and we shall be discussing the latest viral trends of the last week. And I will talk to you all soon.
The snow glows white on the mountain tonight. Not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation. And it looks like
again, this is DJ Synergy on my show Culture Crossover. I'm just getting back from a break. I was trying to play for you a cover of Let It Go, the Oscar-winning hit from Disney's animated smash Frozen, but the computer kind of froze. I couldn't play it for you, so sorry about that. The cover is amazing, though. I can't stop listening to it. I laugh and cry and just smile the whole way through. The singer, he did something different in this version, which was he performed the song in the voices of 21 different characters from Disney and Pixar movies, from Sebastian the Lobster to Winnie the Pooh. It's really funny, and it just kind of puts a smile on your face. The talented young man is Brian Hole, and his video has jumped from 300,000 views to over 2 million views after it was posted on The Blaze. So who exactly is Brian Hole? The Blaze tracked down the talented young man over the weekend, hoping to learn more about him and why exactly he made the video. The 22-year-old is studying music at Dallas Baptist University. His motivation for making the viral clip was to win a chance at a $100 gift card to the Disney store. This man lives, breathes, and does everything Disney, it seems. And he just is the biggest sweetheart. His whole dream job, that is what he told, is that he can be able to use his voice talents in a way that will bring joy to others. He says, "I'm not a working voice talent, but that is one of my dreams to do in the future." When asked about the production of the clip, Hole explained that the YouTube smash was done in just one take, which is really impressive. If you watch the video, you can see him saying all the different accents, and he just transitions so naturally and quickly, and my mind was just blown. And the performance is without any edit, which is even more so crazy, but slight volume adjustments were made to make it easier to hear some of the characters. After the music mix was finished and pictures of the characters were inserted into the video, it was uploaded to Facebook, where Hole's friends gave him glowing reviews. The clip has been submitted to Disney, and Brian still hopes that he scores the $100 gift card. I would not be surprised to hear more from him in the future. Furthermore, Glenn McDuffie, 86, who claimed to be the sailor kissing the woman in the well-known World War II photo, died in a Dallas nursing home Sunday, his daughter told the Associated Press. Life magazine photographer Alfred Einstadt told the iconic photographer took the iconic photograph in New York City on August 14th, 1945, which was the day that Japan surrendered in World War II. A forensic scientist identified McDuffie as the man in 2008. McDuffie told the Associated Press he was changing trains in New York City when he heard the news Japan had surrendered. "I ran out into the street, and then I saw that nurse," he said. "I just went right to her and kissed her. We never spoke a word. Afterward, I just went on the subway across the street and went to Brooklyn." That is such a fascinating story to me. You really don't just have these instances where a photographer captures such a in-the-moment shot, and the two didn't even know each other or speak a word to each other, and now it's one of the most iconic photos of the 20th century. You know, you see that photo, and it really defines what World War II was to America, and it shows the love that was ensued in everything, even though there was war and troubles. Next story is all about Vine, and first there was the planking trend, then there was owling and T-bowing, with many others to follow, but now the latest viral meme craze to hit the internet has to do with Shamu. Whaling has hit the video sharing site Vine with a splash, and it's continuing to make waves throughout the internet, with people acting freer than Willy all over public places. The majestic movement of arching your back and falling to imitate a whale breaching the surface of the ocean has captured the attention of many, including grandmas, babies, and more. While we find these videos hysterical, one must properly learn how to whale safely in order to achieve maximum viral vid shares. So I have for you a breakdown of the fishy and flawless movements. So first, find an elevated surface that is high enough to disappear under. Second, slowly come up and begin to create the curve of your spine. And thirdly, perfect the amazing arch. It's a really hilarious vine, all the vines that I've watched with whaling, and it's really hilarious. You know, people do it in restaurant booths or in bathroom stalls, and it's basically people just flailing all over the place, but it's hilarious. My next story is all about the viral hit. It was a couple months ago when the designer, his last name is Lamb, and his full name is Nikolai Lamb, and he put out a sort of innovative way to the traditional Barbie doll in the and he made a doll with the dimensions of a normal human being. So a few months ago, one of the most iconic toys, Barbie, in the world got a modern makeover so revolutionary that it was completely viral. So now what Nikolai Lamb is doing is he is trying to make a whole doll collection in which little girls can, instead of playing with Barbie dolls, which have a complete disfiguration issue, they could actually play with the Lamely doll. He was motivated by a strong desire to show that average is beautiful, and Lamb has decided to make his designs come to life with a doll called Lamely. Lamb decided to take matters into his own hands after being bombarded with questions about where to buy Barbie of normal size. The entrepreneur is offering prototypes of his toy to the first people to donate to his Crowd Tilt Open campaign. But his plan is to eventually be able to distribute the doll widely online and in retail. The longer-term vision also includes embracing diversity by creating dolls with different ethnic backgrounds and body types. The Lamely doesn't just have the realistic proportions of the average 19-year-old woman, but she also has articulated wrists, knees, elbows, and feet. This is pretty awesome because, unlike her buddy Barbie, who is forever stuck with her arms folded like she's about to serve a cheese plate, Lamely will be able to play sports and other activities. Judging from the picture, Lamely won't constantly be on her tippy toes, which should help prevent the chronic rheumatoid arthritis that has probably been plaguing Barbie for the past half century. Lamely has visibly less makeup, a refreshing change in the age of the freakish Bratz line. Lamb is hoping to capitalize on recent encouraging developments in the toy industry. And Barbie may be one of the most popular toys for young girls, but there's clearly a growing demand for change. The massive popularity of Goldie Blocks, a toy company with a mission to empower girls, isn't a coincidence. It is evidence of this growing trend. Kids and parents alike are asking toy companies to go beyond restrictive gender stereotypes. Plus, while the Barbie doll might be classic, she's also increasingly controversial. Studies show that children who are told to play with a thinner doll eat less food afterwards. And according to the educational website Dying to Be the Barbie, the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders found that to look like Barbie, the average woman would have to grow 2 feet taller, extend their neck length by 3.2 inches, gain 5 inches in the chest, and lose 6 inches in waist circumference. So no wonder children who play with the doll end up with a skewed perception of what beauty is supposed to look like. And even in this year's Sports Illustrated cover featuring Barbie in a bathing suit may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Outrage over Mattel's partnership with the swimsuit issue was not well received, and many called it incredibly creepy, and showed the women's desperate attempt to turn Barbie into a sex object for men. The trend towards heavier sexualization of girls' toys may have finally reached a tipping point with consumers. There's a clear demand for toys that are realistic and appropriate for young girls, and many parents, if they knew there was an option, would buy them. We're seeing incredible momentum in the toy industry, and it's not unrealistic to think that the empowerment of girls won't be something companies even have to think about anymore. It'll be automatic. But until then, Lamely will most certainly do. Meanwhile, a video of a news anchor was uploaded on YouTube following the earthquake in Los Angeles. According to Time, the face of the news anchor, Chris Schwabel, just served an Emmy following the hiding under the table when an earthquake strikes routine was executed. On the other hand, Dr. Lucy Jones of the USGS told KCBS that aftershocks would be felt the whole day. Jones also said that the 2.7 magnitude earthquake was the biggest shaker felt in LA after the Northridge quake in 1994. The U.S. Geological Survey officials said that a bigger earthquake could follow within the next 3 days. The video is so hilarious to see the reaction of Chris, and he's even changed his Twitter account picture to the totally viral face that he makes. There's GIFs all over the web now of his reaction when he gets under the table for cover and then comes up and has the most scared face that I have ever seen on a person when an earthquake is happening. It was really funny, but that really sums it up for today. You've been listening to Culture Crossover. I'm DJ Synergy, and today was mostly about the whole movement towards equality for women and how so much in our culture, be it independent indie news or entertainment culture news, there's really just everywhere the woman is objectified, and we are making advances, but in other ways there's just so much left that we need to do in order to achieve equality. And so most of my stories were in order to kind of help give you an idea of what's really going on. But I think that the whole viral segment was a good one. I think it's funny to kind of discuss what our culture is being entertained by and everything. And in order to close up today's show, I wanted to play for you the song by Brian Hole, his Let It Go cover. So tune in next week on my show, Culture Crossover. This is DJ Synergy. Thank you for listening, and have a great St. Patrick's Day. Thank you.
Worst morning ever. The snow glows white on the mountain tonight. Not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation. And it looks like I'm the queen. Wait, what? The wind is howling like the swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I tried.
Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. Well, now they know.
Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to. Squirrel!
Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway.
Alpha, your voice sounds funny.
I know, I know.
It's funny how some distance makes everything seem small.
And a fear that once gone through me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do. to test the limits and break the rules.
No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free.
Let it go, let it go. I am one with the wind and sky. Wah, 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 wah. Here I'll stand, and here I'll stay. Let the storm rage on.
It's my turn now. Oh. My power flourishes through the air and to the ground. My soul is spiraling in frozen fractals all around. And one thought crystallizes like a honey blast.
I'm never going back. The path is in the past.
Everyone?
Oh, it sure was.
Oh, now can we have some honey?